Hi, my name's Gary King, and I've assembled the most formidable JFK team on planet Earth. We've got Dr. James Fetzer, Larry Rivera, who is the number one researcher in the world today when it comes to new research, and we've got Don Fox, who's not afraid to look a little bit deeper than anyone else. So if you're interested in what happened to the 35th President of the United States, then I invite you to our show. It's called The New JFK Show, and it's on YouTube. Go to Gary King YouTube channel, and we've got over 90 shows archived for you there. So if you really want to know the truth, and knowing that over 9 out of 10 researchers are working the other side of the street in a sea of disinformation, I pledge to you the truth about JFK. Go to Gary King YouTube channel and find out your true history.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You're ready to make to come to the microphone, so they'll listen up.
A new world order.
My name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
I was knocked out the moment upon impact, suffered a concussion from it, and had to be pulled out of the vehicle by witnesses at the scene. My husband, Dennis, was infuriated. He called James Champion that very night.
They continued to threaten us, to shut us down. I was sufficiently frightened. I was followed. She had a car surface in front of her house. So we were in and out of Newtown several times, and each time I was followed.
It was deceptive practice on behalf of this Michael Clary to get his foot in the door to assert that there was some sort of problem with my employer that in fact did not exist. I was summoned to a meeting with the one of the provosts and the dean of my college, as well as a union representative.
Tracy makes the case, if you want to call it that, that news organizations and the government may have worked together to dupe you, the public, in order to gain support for gun control laws.
We want to make it very clear that he was speaking as an individual. The university does not support this position.
Why is it that people who are simply asking questions and seeking information about Adam Lanza and his family are being intimidated, reprimanded, and frightened for their lives? Just what secrets are the authorities withholding about the life of Adam?
I'm a tragic bank. Your daddy ran away. Brother, how does it feel to be me for a day? A picture's worth a thousand words. Fairy tale in a long wolf mask. How do you feel to be me for a day? Monkey see, monkey do, he was raised by you. Doctor said, take your meds, don't forget to make your bed. Monkey see, monkey do, he was raised by you. Did you just say, he was the light?
Adam.
believe that you wasted your life, you will gain nothing from regretting it and will only depress yourself. You cannot change anything from the past. There is something that I can assure you of that will always be true. It does not matter if you live for the next 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, or even 100 years. The day before you die, you will regret ever worrying about your life instead of thinking of what you want to do. Every new year that you do live, you will regret not having started anything that you wanted to do the year prior, only regretting the past more. What I mean is that you should think of what you want to do today, not starting next year or next month, but today. Thinking that you are not going to be able to do anything in the future will only ensure that fate.
That is a quote, not made by Ralph Waldo Emerson or Charles Dickens, but is attributed to Adam Lanza, an alleged madman, addressed to his mother via email, according to the Office of the Child Advocate report. He's been described as a terrorist, a genius, a Nazi, a comedian, a pedophile, a good kid, an animal, kind, stoic, and shy. He is reported to have had his textbooks Xeroxed in black and white because he found color graphics unbearable. Yet he was reported to play an extreme multicolored flashing video game called Dance Dance Revolution for hours on end. They say he wouldn't touch doorknobs because he abhorred touching metal. Yet he was reported to open doors and carry a heavy arsenal of metal into Sandy Hook. He was described as a normal little weird kid, a fitting description considering the paradoxical nature of his life. He was described as extremely anxious, to the point of debilitation. His tech club teacher mentioned he wasn't a bully, rather he was the type of kid who would be bullied.
I identified him as a person likely to be bullied or picked on, and that's when he began to interact with his mother. How was it that she was dealing with him, and what could I do?
Despite this, he somehow overcame his debilitating anxiety and allegedly became the ultimate bully, taking the lives of innocent 6- and 7-year-olds. He destroyed his hard drive, eliminating any incriminating evidence contained on his computer. Yet he committed suicide, eliminating any chance of him being prosecuted, and therefore eliminating any reason to destroy his hard drive. The stream of contradictions is often attributed to his alleged Asperger's syndrome, or autism spectrum disorder. However, according to the Child Advocate report, the Yale Child Study Center did not conclude that Adam even had Asperger's syndrome. In fact, the doctor who gave Adam the diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome, Dr. Paul Fox, fled the country to New Zealand, escaping sexual misconduct charges in July of 2012. Dr. Fox later stated he destroyed Lanza's medical documents. And according to the state police report, Kathleen Koenig, nurse specialist at Yale Child Study Center, changed her diagnosis of Adam from some degree of autism spectrum disorder to obsessive compulsive disorder. Kathleen Koenig contradicts her colleague, Dr. Robert King, who states Lanza appears to fall somewhere in the pervasive development disorder or autistic spectrum disorder. What condition he had or did not have will certainly not be known until Adam's retrievable medical documents are released to the public. Until then, the media and everyone else will continue to speculate. In 2013, the organization Able Child, Parents for Label and Drug-Free Education, attempted to retrieve Adam Lanza's medical documents from the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner. We sat down with Sheila Matthews, co-founder of Able Child, to talk about her experience.
Our organization is a 501c3 nonprofit organization that has been established to raise public awareness regarding the psychiatric labeling and drugging of children and the risks of mandatory mental health screening. So basically, Able Child was called in to the Sandy Hook investigation on the ground by a local Sandy Hook parent who was concerned that Adam Lanza was being medicated through psychiatric drugs, and that was potentially a source of his violent act. And so therefore, Abel Child decided to investigate to see if indeed he was provided mental health treatment and what that mental health treatment consisted of. When we arrived, the assistant attorney general arrived on behalf of the state and handed our attorney a document, which was a report from the Hartford Courant, report saying that the toxicology report was released to the public. And this was prior to us sitting down to do our FOIA request for that exact documentation. However, it was just a story in the Hartford Courant, and there was no toxicology report attached to that story. We were handed the cover sheet of the toxicology report, but it didn't have any of the lab work. It was indeed a cover sheet saying that no drugs were found in his system, but it did not go into the lab work of what tests were conducted, the amounts that were found to determine that finding. So it was an incomplete toxicology report. Then when we sat down in front of the commission, I think our attorney presented a well-rounded, thorough case. And then when it was the state's turn, they brought up the issue of the psychiatric drugs, which was shocking to us because we were at the beginning portion of the FOIA request, and he brought the issue up and basically said the reason why they don't want to disclose it is because everybody would go off their meds.
So it's simply not legitimate, and not only is it not the use to which you're proposing to put the information not legitimate, it is harmful, because then you can cause a lot of people to stop taking their medications, stop cooperating with their treating physicians, because of the heinousness of what Adam Lanza did.
The state went on to try to discredit Abel Child, is saying that we were not a stakeholder representing the public. His argument was that Abel Child didn't deserve the information because of what we would do with that information. I felt that our attorney hammered the issue. The next of kin rule that was posted on the chief medical examiner's website, they basically created a rule and put it on their website but didn't have public open hearings to create it as a law. You can't just post something on your website and say it's law.
So this is a case of first impression for the commission, and one that is a case of first impression for you as well. In
the legality of how
they adopted
defined legitimate interest.
Yes, they did not have, under the Open Meetings Act and under the Administrative Procedure Act for the state, the power to unilaterally adopt a substantive rule without following legal process.
But if they adopted this more of an informal way of determining who has legitimate interests, it's almost like a procedure they follow instead of a formal process or formal rule.
It cannot be considered a procedure because it affects the substantive rights under the FOIC and under the OCME of the party seeking information. To make that argument, you would have to conclude that no member of the public ever has a right of access to information.
We won in the sense we had the state admit the reason why they're holding it back is clearly due to their own fears of giving the consumer the right to choose.
We, the people, are at the mercy of the media and government, hoping they disseminate accurate information. They have failed us miserably to the point that the failure has to be considered deliberate. Despite the fact that the Connecticut State Police claim to have various photos of Adam, we are limited to a select few, some of which appear to be grainy, altered, and possibly even photoshopped. Thank you. The origin of the famous bug-eyed photograph of Adam Lanza is not known, but has been used as the main picture circulated by the media and shows signs of being altered. Two other bug-eyed photos also appear altered to provide a skewed perception. One is allegedly a Western Connecticut State University ID, and the other is claimed to be his tech club ID. The alteration of the eyes has been used by the media in the past. A similar example occurred in Port Arthur, Australia, to alleged mass killer Martin Bryant.
In no paper was there any fiddling with the picture. The eyes were shown thus, except in the Australian. There, the whites were painted in and the pupils were darkened. Result, the eyes of a crazy killer.
Something as simple as birth and death records is even controversial when studying the life of Adam. In the state police report, for example, a release form is included. Peter signs off on Adam's date of birth as being 4/10/1988, the birth date of Adam's brother Ryan. Furthermore, the vital records of the town of Kingston, New Hampshire, 1694 to 1994, lists Nancy and Peter as having only one son, Adam. Digital copies of Adam and Ryan's birth records can be found in the annual report of the town of Kingston for the years of 1988 and 1992 respectively, supplied online by the University of New Hampshire Library. Adam's original death certificate, according to the Social Security Death Index, had the date December 13, 2012, the day prior to the shooting. John Greenwald of the website The Black Vault obtained an FOIA request in 2013 concerning Adam's death certificate. He obtained two documents and explains. The first, dated 1/15/13, showed Adam P. Lanza's death occurred on 12/13/12, the day prior to the shooting. The second document, dated 1/24/13, showed Lanza's death as 12/14/12, with a handwritten statement at the top, quoted, amended 1/24/13, and the initials SMO. Controversy over the release of death certificates began with Debbie Aurelia, future wife of Sandy Hook Fire Chief Bill Halstead, who broke the law by refusing FOI requests from people seeking copies of death certificates. Death certificates have long been available to the public. At the time of death, Adam Lanza was listed as being 6 feet tall and weighing 112 pounds. As a comparison, the actor Christian Bale is listed as being 6 feet tall. According to the DVD commentary of the movie The Machinist, Bale reduced his body weight down to 120 pounds to fit his character. He was 8 pounds heavier than Lanza. According to the OCA report, Lanza was 5'10", 112 pounds in 2008. In 4 years, Lanza gained 2 inches in height, but stayed the exact same weight. He was deemed anorexic by the OCA. It makes one wonder exactly what morgue technician Jean Henry and her husband viewed when they unzipped the bag containing the alleged body of Lanza.
You know, when you first hear it, you kind of do a double take. Really showing the body of Adam Lanza, going in and literally unzipping the body bag? That's what the allegations are, and the investigation has been launched.
Today, the governor confirmed that there is an internal investigation going on in the medical examiner's office. Processing tech Jean Henry was put on leave after she allegedly brought her husband into the morgue, unzipping the body bag of Sandy Hook shooter Adam Lanza to show her husband.
An investigation is ongoing. I would be deeply disappointed if it was proven to be true, and would expect, if it was proven to be true, that whatever steps are appropriate would be taken.
Why would somebody even be interested in opening up a body bag if you have no relationship to the guy?
Given the fact that the media, which was our main source of information for almost an entire year, was so obviously wrong on so many levels, it would only make sense for the people to have access to critical documents. This would give the public an opportunity to check the accuracy of the reporting. Let's quickly review the infamous misreporting of the media.
and the gunman was identified at 11:28 as, again, 24-year-old Ryan Lanza of New Jersey.
They're doing background investigations into the shooter, but they're also going to locations associated with the shooter, not just directly associated with Ryan Lanza, his residence, and they're looking for a location in New Jersey there.
Cops have identified the shooter as a 24-year-old man, Ryan Lanza.
We have just now confirmed apparently the shooter is identified. He is 20-year-old Ryan Lanza.
We do know it is a person whose surname is Lanza.
Absolutely.
And whose mother was a kindergarten teacher at Sandy Hook Elementary School and was killed this morning in her classroom.
I did ask if it was known around this school that this young man, apparently a kindergarten teacher's son, was an issue, whether he had any problems, and she said not at all. And I asked if she knew the suspect's mother, and she said she did, and that she was an absolutely loving person and a very caring, experienced kindergarten teacher.
Adam had been carrying Ryan's ID, and Peter knew it wasn't Ryan, but when he saw what had happened, he knew it must be Adam.
You have different explanations as to why they got the names wrong. One report out there is that Adam Lanza had Ryan Lanza's ID on him.
Now, here we go. Adam Lanza's older brother, Ryan, 24 years old of Hoboken, New Jersey, is being questioned by police, said the first official. Earlier, a law enforcement official mistakenly transposed the brothers' first names.
Even authorities admitted they were confused by all of this, but now they have come out and said what happened is they switched the names. Now we're being told that the father reportedly was said to be killed inside that house, and now authorities are saying, no, the father is alive, but there is somebody who was shot and killed inside that house.
On the 13th of December, Adam Lanza went to the school, a couple of officials have told us, and got in some kind of altercation, is the word that they use, between him and four other staff members. Now, they say that of the four staff members that he got into an argument with, three were killed in yesterday's shooting. A fourth person was not there.
And I want to ask you something that Pete Williams reported first on Saturday. He said there had been some kind of an altercation at Sandy Hook Elementary School the day before the shootings, and that it was believed Adam Lanza might have been involved in that altercation with up to four teachers or administrators. Can you shed any light on that?
That's been spoken about a great deal during the number of press conferences that we've had, and we've been able to look at that and find out that there was no report of any altercation involving the shooter, the suspect, if you will, at all at that facility.
If we were to rely solely on the media, we wouldn't know if Adam Lanza completely dropped out of high school, got a GED, or received a diploma. CBS reports that he earned a GED after dropping out of high school. The Frontline documentary Raising Adam Lanza states that Nancy took Adam out of high school in 2008, but doesn't specify the reason why, or if he was working towards his diploma at home. Media sources indicate that Adam started taking college courses at Western Connecticut State University in the summer of 2008, when he was only 16 years old. Some sources state Adam's enrollment at the university was done to either finish high school or earn a GED. However, by looking at the transcript provided by the New York Daily News, it shows that the courses Adam was taking were college-level undergraduate classes, indicating that Adam was earning part-time college credits for his future college education. Although we are prohibited from viewing a copy, Book 4 of the State Police Report states that it has, in its possession, a Newtown High School diploma for the shooter dated June 25th of 2009. Adam was only 17 in June of 2009, indicating that he graduated a year early. This is in direct contradiction to the Hartford Courant, who claimed one particular student sat next to Adam in homeroom during their senior year of 2010. The Child Advocate Report is clear on their stance. They state that not only did Adam graduate early, but the school was working with Adam to achieve his goal. His goal of graduating early and attending college classes did not seem inappropriate for a youth the school saw as gifted with a voracious appetite for learning. A.L. communicated his goal of graduating early from high school, and staff worked with him to assist with earning the necessary credits. By the beginning of A.L.'s junior year, he had accumulated 11.5 credits towards the required 20 for graduation. By the end of the year, he was credited with 21, which allowed him to graduate a year early. Here, A.L. not only had a paucity of transition planning, he graduated early from high school. End quote. To confirm Adam's presence at Newtown High School, various researchers attempted but failed to obtain hard copies of yearbooks from the local Newtown library. At the time of the release of this documentary, we have yet to obtain or view a copy of a Newtown High School yearbook from the years 2006 to 2009. Now recall Connecticut State Police spokesman Lieutenant Paul Vance's threat to those posting misinformation on social media.
One thing that's becoming somewhat of a concern, and that is misinformation is being posted on social media sites. There has been misinformation coming from people posing as the shooter in this case, posing using other IDs, mimicking this crime and crime scene and criminal activity that took place in this community. There's been some things in somewhat of a threatening manner. It is important to know that we have discussed with federal authorities that these issues are crimes. They will be investigated statewide and federally, and prosecution will take place when people perpetrating this information are identified.
Perhaps Mr. Vance should have directed his threat towards both the mainstream media and himself, because he too provided us with blatant disinformation.
And where was the gunman found?
In the hallway.
Outside a classroom?
Correct.
The gunman, according to the police report, was found in classroom 10, not the hallway. It is important here to note that Lieutenant Paul Vance's son, J. Paul Vance Jr., became the claims commissioner for the state of Connecticut in August of 2011, a little over a year before Sandy Hook. Vance Jr. made the following statement upon being hired. Connecticut has sovereign immunity, and no one can sue the state without the permission of the claims commissioner. I'm the gatekeeper. Adam Lanza allegedly became a recluse during his final years, hiding in his bedroom with his windows blacked out, playing violent video games, and chatting on anarchical websites while plotting mass murders on a 7-foot by 5-foot spreadsheet. A spreadsheet, by the way, that has not been released to the public. Neighbors have seemingly lost track of Adam's whereabouts from 2009 to 2012.
It's a mystery. And all the reporters have been asking around if anybody knows them on the block, and nobody knows them, which is odd for this neighborhood. It's very odd because a lot of people in this neighborhood know each other, and that if they don't know each other, they know of somebody.
Somehow, despite reports of his reclusiveness and isolation, he is reported to spend hours at a time at the local theater playing Dance Dance Revolution. There has yet to be a clear motive attributed to Adam Lanza for his alleged crimes. Despite this fact, the media continues to speculate and theorize. James Tracy, professor at Florida Atlantic University, had his run-in with the media for questioning Sandy Hook. We talked with him about his experience in interacting with the media, as well as his thoughts on Adam Lanza.
I was contacted on, I believe it was January 7th of 2013, by a journalist for the South Florida Sun Sentinel by the name of Michael Clary. Now, the South Florida Sun Sentinel, it's important to keep in mind, is kind of a subtext here that it's a Tribune Company newspaper owned by the Zionist Sam Zell, who may or may not have played a role in this. But the Hartford Courant is also owned by the Tribune Company, and they surely played a major role in presenting the Sandy Hook massacre event. So this Michael Clary contacted me at my residence and remarked that, well, Professor Tracy, James, we understand that you're in a row with the administration concerning your blog that has become controversial, and I wondered if you'd like to talk about that. Well, I heard nothing. I knew nothing about this. And it turns out, in fact, that the administration knew nothing about my blog until this story was published on, I believe, January 8th of 2013. And then eventually it was picked up by the Drudge Report, and it, you know, became an international story of the conspiracy theory professor. But it was kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it was deceptive practice on behalf of this Michael Clary to get his foot in the door to assert that there was some sort of problem with my employer that, in fact, did not exist. I knew an individual who was working in the administration at my university at Florida Atlantic who contacted me and said, by the way, we heard from this reporter by the name of Michael Clary. Maybe he's contacted you. The people here didn't even know that you had a website, and now we do. So more or less about the time it was published. What this journalist was attempting to do was to make me appear to be as outrageous as possible. He ultimately wanted me to go on the record saying that, yes, there were crisis actors that were at Sandy Hook. Now, I did write an article, I believe, a few days prior to this on January 2nd, January 1st, on the blog that suggested the possibility of this based on the media reports, which looked, you know, somewhat sketchy in terms of whether or not this was an actual event. Just not only the interviewees, but all sorts of other things too, and conflicting information that I had questions about. So I said there are these crisis actors that are commissioned by the Department of Homeland Security. So it's not that outlandish of an assertion. And I was not saying anything that would confirm this, but I was just suggesting this as a possibility. But he wanted for me to say, in fact, and repeatedly was on the phone with me two or three times throughout the day trying to get me to go on the record saying that this, that I was asserting that there were crisis actors there. And I never made that argument in that sort of way. I've since contacted Michael Clary and asked him about the interview and how he got the information that I was somehow in conflict with the administration here concerning my blog, and he claims to have no recollection of our encounter, which is rather unusual because this is probably one of the most important stories he ever broke. I've since gone back and looked at the coverage of mass shootings over the years, the most well-known being on August 1st of 1966 at the University of Texas in Austin by Charles Whitman, who went up to the UT Tower some 38 stories above the campus and began shooting and went on shooting for 80 minutes. You've probably heard about this case. There were about three dozen people that were injured. There were, I believe, 17 or 18 people that were killed, the fatalities. But if you look at the coverage of events like that and subsequent mass shootings that are bona fide, that did in fact take place, it's completely accurate. There's no wavering. There's no amending the story as we see so frequently now. And this was done before the age of the internet, when journalists had to use the telephone to relay their reports, the telegraph perhaps. But the technology itself was much, much cruder. Was much more primitive, if you will, versus today where we have the internet. And you can make the argument, well, yeah, maybe social media kind of muddies the picture to a certain degree, and that might be true, but the reports, say, from the Sandy Hook massacre, for example, or the Boston Marathon bombing, these were received from federal agencies. So how is it that they're getting the story and the information wrong? Whereas years ago when you had these various mass shootings where there were solely local and regional authorities involved in actually addressing the event, processing the crime scene, everything was was presented in terms of the types of weapons used with the UT Austin shooting back in 66. The actual psychiatric record of the individual was released the following day. Officials close to the situation say these are more or less designated leaks where the those who are involved in the whatever the situation may be are seeking to develop a narrative by using their sources in the media, at major, you know, prestige publications, New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, or what have you. And there's a prevalence of this now. And yet, I don't think it's questioned to the extent that it should be. And we also saw this with the Sandy Hook massacre. Officials say, and officials got it wrong.
By now, we all know the story. The media painted us a picture of the Lanza family, so we didn't have to do our own research. Nancy was portrayed as a gun enthusiast, a type of prepper who coddled her already anxiety-ridden, autistic, and problematic son to the point of seclusion and psychosis. We can hear the media theorizing now. If Nancy had continued medicating Adam, would this have still happened? If she hadn't given Adam access to firearms, it may have prevented Sandy Hook. To the media, Adam's demise was the direct result of Nancy's decisions. And to politicians, the story was tailor-made for pushing draconian gun and mental health laws. Adam's father, Peter, was first reported to be an adjunct professor at Northeastern University in Boston. Later reports indicated that he was the vice president for taxes at General Electric, previously working as a senior tax manager at Ernst & Young. Ernst & Young being the reported place of employment for Adam's brother, Ryan. In an email provided by the child advocate, attributed to Peter Lanza and addressed to Adam, it states, "Teaching postgraduate classes for the last 15 years makes me qualified to coach you." Later reports indicated that Peter Lanza was able to split time between his job at General Electric, teaching as an adjunct professor, and teaching classes at Fairfield University. As stated, Peter and Nancy finalized their divorce in September of 2009, to which Peter agreed to pay an annual alimony beginning in 2010 of $240,000 with increases each year. By 2015, Nancy would have received nearly $300,000. It is implied that the divorce disturbed Adam enough to the point of breaking off his relationship with both his father and brother. But is any of this true? We have reason to believe that the very foundation of the Lanza family story should be called into question. Sabrina Phillips is the author of Making a Killing: The Unofficial Story of the Sandy Hook Massacre. In her book, she outlines a discrepancy in the genealogy of Nancy Lanza. Here is what she told us.
Looking into the family of Nancy Lanza, we found some really interesting things, particularly on the Champion side of things. Before Nancy was a Lanza, Adam's mother, she was a Champion. So that's kind of where we started when we were looking into her. Going off of the media reports and the official report, Nancy was born in Salem, Massachusetts on September 6, 1960 to Donald Champion and Dorothy Champion. Dorothy, Nancy's supposed mother, her maiden name is Hughes. Nancy grew up in the small town of Kingston, New Hampshire on her farm that her family had inherited from their Irish ancestors, and she built her first house with Peter Lanza next to her family home. So we thought we had a clear picture of the Champion family until we stumbled upon an obituary by using certain keywords. So for example, we used various combinations of the name Champion, like Chapman, you know, just different variations of the names, to any connections to a Nancy Lanza or a Nancy Champion. And within looking at that, we found an Eleanor Champion. And an obituary for this Eleanor Champion is listed on the St. Petersburg Times website under obituaries for the year 2000. And it states that Eleanor was living in Brooksville, Florida at the time of her death, and a Nancy Champion is included in her obituary. In this obituary, though, Nancy was in or from New Jersey at the time. It says Nancy Champion of New Jersey is who the daughter she leaves behind. Also is a Donald Champion Jr., who is listed as her son in that obituary, also living in or from New Jersey. If you look at Nancy Lanza's obituary on the internet, you will see that Nancy does in fact have a brother named Donald Champion Jr. after her father. And she also has a younger brother named James Champion and an older sister named Carol Gould, who lives in Maine. Now, Carol and James were not included in the obituary for this Eleanor Champion that we found, but Donald Jr. and Nancy Champion were two names that were included. So we kept looking at Eleanor. And as we did, certain connections started to come about. For instance, the Brooksville, Florida connection. It states that Eleanor was living in Brooksville at the time of her death. Brooksville would be the same place that Dorothy Champion, the woman claiming to be Nancy's mother, was living in at the time of the shooting. And we know this because, as you point out on InsaneMedia.net, in your analysis of the PBS special Raising Adam Lanza, that when Dorothy Champion was contacted for comment by the press in Brooksville, Florida, she was identified as the mother of Nancy Lanza and the grandmother of Adam. And of course, she told the press at the time, quote, "I just don't know and I can't make a comment right now." And she eventually ended up hanging up on the Tampa Bay Times reporter. So the Brooksville connection between this Eleanor Champion and Dorothy Champion lined up right off the bat. But it wasn't enough to completely convince us that these two people were connected at all. Being a citizen journalist is tough these days because there's such limited and conflicting information out there for us to look at. We got very good at using sites that were readily available, such as Spokio and Intellius, and we started with the woman claiming to be Nancy's mother, Dorothy. So we found several addresses attached to Dorothy's name, ranging in places like Brooksville, Florida, St. Augustine, Florida, and of course Kingston, New Hampshire, all the same person, different addresses. We went through each and every one of those addresses, and it wasn't until our last one that we could finally put one more crucial connection and a possible link between Eleanor Champion and Dorothy Champion. That particular address that we linked back with those two was 382 Mount Richmond Avenue Northeast in St. Augustine, Florida, because that very same address lists Eleanor Champion, Dorothy Champion, and Donald Champion Sr. as all having lived there together. So that's awkward, to say the least. The final confirmation for the connection between Eleanor Champion and Nancy Champion's supposed mother in the media, Dorothy, I turned to my friend and professional genealogist, Michael Megason, and he was able to actually obtain marriage records. He looked for every Donald Champion in the state of Florida, as well as New Hampshire. Now, there are no licenses for a Dorothy Hughes and a Donald Champion in either state, but there was a marriage license for a Donald Champion and an Eleanor Marie Bestricki in Pinellas County, Florida. Eleanor was using her former marriage name when she married Nancy's father, Donald. So it was her second marriage. She married a Bestricki first. Her maiden name is actually Hummel, Eleanor Marie Hummel. So this had us excited because it was a concrete connection that, for some reason, was hidden by both law enforcement and the media for reasons unknown. And the most shining verification I have of this work came from actually Adam Lanza's mentor, former mentor himself, and Newtown security advisor, Richard Novia, when I spoke with him over the phone and filled him in on my findings on this mysterious Eleanor Champion. He himself told me, quote, "Yes, very good. You're on one track." He made it quite clear that Nancy's family had indeed been tampered with in the media and the official report.
Perhaps this discrepancy in Nancy's genealogy is the reason why her immediate family has remained silent and has not come to her defense against the attacks made by media. Researching the Lanza family myth even further, we have looked into an article published by James Tracy's Memory Hole blog, outlining a strange connection between Peter, Nancy, and Nancy's brother James Champion with Alexander Izgut, a pediatrician from Argentina. Alexander Izgut and his wife moved to Newtown, Connecticut in 1975, where he eventually bought up several properties. He has connections to Yale, Danbury Hospital, and is known to have been the pediatrician of alleged Sandy Hook victim Olivia Engel. He remains in Newtown to this day. According to current real estate records, it is Alexander Isgut who owns Nancy's and Peter's old Kingston, New Hampshire home. The Washington Post goes on to state, Isgut said his daughter bought the property in 1998 from the boy's mom, Nancy Lanza. The Washington Post continues, my daughter called me for other reasons that Friday morning, and I told her there has been a massacre here. At that time, the name Ryan Lanza came on TV, and I told her, and she said, oh my God, that's the people I bought the house from. According to real estate records, Alexander Isgut took over the Kingston residence when his daughter granted him the property in 2011. Think about this for a moment. What are the odds that Nancy and Peter Lanza moved from Kingston, New Hampshire to Newtown, Connecticut, the same town in which the new owners reside, and yet there is no mutual relationship? Furthermore, Duke Reichert, the author of the Memory Hole blog article, also found a common location between Alexander Isgut and Nancy's alleged brother, James Champion. Along with being neighbors in Kingston, they both held residences in Summertown, Tennessee. During the night of the event, the FBI told the Isguts not to speak about the case.
WBZ-TV Learning tonight, Mrs. Lanza and her husband and kids lived next door to her brother before moving to Connecticut over a decade ago. The current homeowners telling us the FBI told them not to speak about the case.
In 2013, while investigating the Lanzas, Sabrina Phillips and her husband attempted to make contact with James Champion. Upon calling the Champion residence, a woman answered.
My husband Dennis, based off of his prior knowledge of who was listed on the house that we found on records and by the tone of the woman's voice trying to pinpoint an age range for who this person might be, he was able to distinguish it was most likely Kathleen Champion. So going off of his intuition, he asked to speak with Kathleen Champion. And the woman, very almost annoyed, said, yeah, go ahead. Still unsure if this was a validation or not, if we were speaking with Kathleen, Dennis again asked, is this Kathleen Champion? To which she gave a very clear yes. So he introduced himself to her as an independent genealogist who was having trouble connecting her side of the family to the Lanzas. And then he asked, do you think you could help me out? Her response was probably not. So Dennis asked if there was any particular reason as to why, and then with that, she drew in a deep breath, confirming my suspicion she was annoyed, and asked, where are you calling from? Again, Dennis told her he was an independent genealogist, and after another long and awkward pause, she said, we have a very bad connection here, and I can't understand what you're saying. Dennis tried repeating his statements, but she interrupted him, and she told him to try calling again, and hung up the phone. It was 8 minutes later, while we were still calming down and collecting our thoughts and talking to one another about it, that we received a phone call from Kathleen Champion. I won't forget that moment because it was chilling. We used Star 67 when we called the Champion residence. Never in all of our years have we ever gotten a call back from a number that we had Star 67 beforehand, ever. This was a first for me. So Kathleen Champion in the old home of Nancy Lanza's on Depot Road somehow had the means to call us back, even though we used a block number to contact her first. All because after 8 minutes, I think we took too long for her liking to call her back. We had gotten on her radar, we had annoyed her, and she wanted to speak and see what we had to say. February 17th of this year, 2015, I was involved in an auto accident where I was hit nearly head-on. The crash wrecked my 2011 Hyundai Sonata. All the airbags deployed. I passed out upon the impact of the airbag deploying. Witnesses pulled me out of the vehicle. Miraculously, I only suffered from a minor burn from the airbag, a bruising, an ankle sprain, and a concussion. That night, I looked into the person that hit me, as listed on the official police report that I was given from the accident, because this person was exhibiting some strange behavior at the scene of the accident. They had a man show up and was arguing on the side of the road with this person. I ended up looking into them, and this person had ties to Hartford, Connecticut. Their spouse had worked for a company called Tektronix, and prior to that had worked for General Electric in Connecticut. This was all verified as well by a source that I have in Newtown, Connecticut, the only person I speak with in Newtown, Connecticut. I was horrified, to say the least. And I still can't prove that this person really does have any connection to Sandy Hook or the knowledge of the research I was doing at the time, but it sure opened a lot of doors because we went hard when we were trying to talk with people. It wasn't the same anymore. My husband, Dennis, was infuriated. He was ticked off enough, even the thought of the possibility of an attempt on my life, that he called James Champion that very night and left him one of the most amazing voice messages. It was so awesome that James decided to reach out the next day and actually text the phone number back, which was my cell phone, all because Dennis told him about the crash. So I thought it was interesting that after all that time, James Champion finally wrote back the day after my auto accident. So for nothing else, I'm happy that it opened some doors because he texted the cell phone the next day and claimed he could only communicate via text since he had company over and couldn't talk. We had an interesting interaction that spanned over 2 hours, and I asked him the things I always wanted to ask him. I told him that we were trying to make sense of this all and that we didn't press Kathleen after she told us her husband died and didn't want to talk. He replied by saying, "You couldn't have spoken to Kathleen. The person you talked to at my house wasn't Kathy. I was divorced 8 years ago." That's when I told them that I had recorded the conversation of someone picking up his phone and claiming to be Kathleen Champion. So how I see it is that James Champion knowingly or unknowingly lied to me and then backed down after knowing I had irrefutable proof of Kathleen being at his residence as of 2013. Why would he do that?
Immediately after the event, Ryan Lanza was taken into custody for what they claimed was his own protection. Peter Lanza was also able to avoid the media shortly after Maggie Gordon, a Stanford Advocate reporter, confronted him at his Stanford home. Both he and Ryan, upon leaving the police station, can be seen fleeing from the cameras. Shortly after the event, Edelman, the largest independent public relations firm in the world, would become the spokespeople for the Lanzas. Through Edelman, Peter has been able to insulate himself from opening up to the media. Representing the Lanzas on behalf of Edelman is Errol Cofield. Errol Cofield was covered briefly in We Need to Talk About Sandy Hook. With over 150 employees living in Newtown, General Electric has been connected with the town for many years. After Sandy Hook, GE Capital became known as Newtown's fairy godmother as it donated $15 million towards healing. General Electric has long been under public scrutiny, especially following the report by Business Insider stating General Electric paid no federal U.S. taxes in 2010. Peter Lanza's ties to General Electric as the vice president of taxes raised suspicion early on, especially with its possible collusion with Wall Street banks during the LIBOR scandal. However, because his PR firm kept him concealed from the public, Peter was able to avoid any questions towards not only his son, but as to whether or not he had any involvement with the scandal, which reached its peak in 2012. Surprisingly, no major news corporation, not Oprah, not Katie Couric, or anyone else, has brought us a blockbuster interview with the shooter's father, Peter Lanza. The only interview done by a member of the media was curiously done off camera. 6 months after the event, a memorial service was held for Nancy Lanza in New Hampshire. Peter Lanza allegedly made an appearance. A photo provided by the Hartford Courant captures an image of a limo with Ryan sitting beside a man who may possibly be his father. Ahead of them are James Champion, Dorothy Champion, Donald Champion Jr., and an unknown, unidentified woman sitting in between Dorothy and Donald. The Office of the Child Advocate released their review regarding Adam Lanza on November 21, 2014. Their responsibility was to develop any recommendations for public health system improvement that emanated from their review. While the public has yet to have access to all of Lanza's medical information, the authors of the report were privy to both the unredacted police report and Adam Lanza's medical records.
The fact that the public has yet to be made aware of all the information regarding Adam Lanza's medical and mental health records is a scandal. Able Child did all it could within its financial capabilities to bring some transparency to the issue. Our attorney brought that up in the FOIA hearings, that the information is not under the privacy laws because some of the information was being released to some people and not to other people, which brings in the, he said, the 14th Amendment of the equal rights and equal protection. So we had a lot of constitutional issues brought up in that FOIA request. The Child Advocates Office was privy to the unredacted state police report and basically wrote a story about Lanza. The story is a miserable and embarrassing excuse for an investigative review. As Able Child reported on December 1st of 2014, when we wrote an article called Local Newspapers Conflict with OCA's Report on Adam Lanza, and that OCA is the Office of the Child Advocate. What we did was we went through her report, and basically her report excluded facts, and they came up with a narrative, which is a story. It is not a fact-based document that the public can look at and say, oh, here is this, and here is this, and this makes sense. Instead, we got a story, a narrative, and the Office of the Child Advocate withheld important key information. And that is embarrassing, and it is a poor excuse for an investigative review in the aftermath of a deadly mass shooting.
It is absolutely impossible to discern, without access to Lanza's medical and school records, exactly what, if anything, was physically, emotionally, or mentally wrong with Adam. As Able Child states, the OCA report is written in the form of a narrative, a story, and one should not use their report in determining future mental health programs. While the makers of this documentary have not relied on this report in seeking accurate information pertaining to Adam's life, much of what investigators know about Adam Lanza is dependent on this report. The opinion of the makers of this film has remained constant. Unless the public has access to the same documents as the authors of the OCA report, the story contained therein should be viewed with intense skepticism. Furthermore, a very conspicuous error from the OCA report could very well be proof that the state of Connecticut, through multiple agencies, has knowingly deceived the public by changing and altering the story of Adam Lanza's life and education. More specifically, conflicting information between the Hartford Courant, the Sadensky Report, and the Child Advocate Report is brought to light by looking at Adam's 8th grade school year. All three bodies, the Courant, the State Police, and the authors of the Child Advocate Report, had exclusive access to Adam's medical and schooling records. One, if not all, are lying. The Child Advocate is quite clear about what Adam was doing his 8th grade year, as it states, AL's anxiety began to further impact his ability to attend school, and in 8th grade he was placed on homebound status through his education plan, a placement for children that are too disabled, even with supports and accommodations, to attend school. AL had several sessions with a community psychiatrist between ages 13 and 15, though there are no medical records regarding this physician's treatment. Through brief correspondence with the school, the psychiatrist supported Mrs. Lanza's desire to withdraw AL from the school setting in 8th grade. The district provided little surveillance of AL's homebound status, which lasted an entire school year. In March 2006, the psychiatrist responded to a request for information from the school district regarding AL's availability for standardized testing. The school district sent a note to the psychiatrist stating, "In order to exempt AL from taking the CMTS, we need a letter from you indicating that he is unable to attend school and is medically, emotionally unavailable for homebound instruction for the testing period and the makeup testing period." Without this letter, we are mandated to send a certified teacher to AL's house to give him the test. The psychiatrist responded with a faxed note that AL was medically, emotionally unavailable to be tested. According to the psychiatrist, AL could not and was not receiving homebound or hospital-based tutoring, and he was not attending school at all. This is fascinating. In March of 2006, the community psychiatrist states that AL was not receiving homebound tutoring and was not attending school at all. However, the OCA report omits a very important fact that not only contradicts their report, but puts their integrity into question. Between March of 2006 and July of 2006, Adam Lanza's name appears three times within the Newtown B articles listing honor roll students. The list of second quarter honor roll students was published in March of 2006. Adam Lanza's name appears under the 8th grade honor roll. The third quarter honor roll list was released by the Newtown Bee in May of 2006. Adam Lanza's name appears under 8th grade honor roll. And the fourth quarter list was published on July 20th, 2006. Once again, Adam Lanza's name is listed under the 8th grade honor roll. How could the OCA, with access to all Lanza's medical and school records, omit such a glaring detail about his life? But perhaps more importantly, why would they do such a thing? And why is there such confusion about what was going on during Lanza's 8th grade year? The Hartford Courant, who in mid-2013 was allowed access to view Adam Lanza's medical and educational records, collaborated on the PBS Frontline investigation, Raising Adam Lanza, in February 2013. The corresponding article states, Adam began 8th grade at St. Rose of Lima School in Newtown, but he stayed for less than half the year before Nancy Lanza withdrew her son, officials said. On June 30, 2013, the Courant changed its stance. In a new article entitled Adam Lanza's Medical Records Reveal Growing Anxiety, the Courant states that they obtained exclusive information from medical and school records that have for months been kept secret by agencies investigating the shootings. Part of this information seems to be that Adam started 8th grade at Newtown Middle School, not St. Rose of Lima. The Courant goes on to state that while attending Newtown Middle School, Adam was presenting as more anxious, particularly in groups, leading to an emergency room visit at Danbury Hospital in September 2005. The preliminary report released by Connecticut State's Attorney Stephen Sedensky, which relied on the Connecticut State Police, who were privy to all of Lanza's records from the earliest stages, states the shooter went through the Newtown public school system, though part of 7th grade and part of 8th grade were done at St. Rose of Lima School in Newtown. Even though the emergency room visit during Adam's 8th grade year could be viewed as a crucial moment in understanding what Adam was doing during 8th grade, the Sedensky report fails to mention it. A glaring omission, considering the state police, at 5 p.m. on the day of the event, during the chaos of the day, made it a point to obtain Adam's pediatric records. These records were seemingly much more important compared to, say, Adam's phone records, which weren't obtained until February 12, 2013, nearly 2 months later.
You have these very kind of episodic appearances of Lanza, but there's no consistent, you know, a record of him having existed. I believe that perhaps he was a composite of a number of individuals rather than one particular individual. But of course, you could find the ISP has would have that record, the internet service provider, and that would be subject to subpoena by the appropriate law enforcement in Connecticut. Why hasn't that been examined? It should be part of the record. If this was something that was actually on the up and up, there'd be no reason to keep that under wraps. It doesn't make any sense. And looking at the larger picture, we have entities like the National Security Agency. They are keeping tabs on everyone. They have a broad view of what is taking place. They have a record of what has taken place at Boston, marathon bombing. They know what took place at Sandy Hook, at Aurora. I think that it's probably at variance with what the public is being told through the news media.
Why is it so difficult for these organizations to interpret exactly what Adam was doing during his eighth grade school year? It surely can't be because they are incompetent, can it? After all, they are the ones who are deemed responsible enough to view the documents. Furthermore, according to the OCA report, Yale Child Study Center clinicians did not conclude that Adam Lanza was high-functioning or that he definitely had Asperger's syndrome. Rather, they found him as profoundly impaired and debilitated by anxiety, with extensive special education therapeutic needs. That's interesting as well. Yale Child Study Center states that Adam was not high-functioning. Yet, not only does Adam's name appear under 8th grade honor roll recipients, but his name is seen on the honor roll during the 9th grade, 10th grade, and he was even granted summa cum laude honors for his 10th grade Latin class. On top of that, according to the OCA, Adam graduated a year early. What an amazing feat for a kid who was not highly functioning. We are to believe that Adam Lanza was so racked with anxiety, so debilitated to have been placed on homebound status to the point of being unavailable for any instruction whatsoever from March 2006 to the end of the school year. Yet there he is, listed on the honor roll, proving that not only was he highly functioning, but he was receiving instruction. Just what exactly is going on here, and why is there such blatantly conflicting accounts? Besides providing information from the unredacted state police report and undisclosed and unverifiable medical records, the child advocate quotes both a psychiatrist accused of sexual misconduct and a biased advocate for the pharmaceutical industry. Dr. Paul Fox is said to have been Adam Lanza's community psychiatrist. He is the man who stated AL could not and was not receiving homebound or hospital-based tutoring and was not attending school at all during 8th grade. Recall in July of 2012, just 5 months before the event, Dr. Fox surrendered his license to practice in both Connecticut and New York following multiple allegations of sexual relationships or sexual behavior with clients. To avoid prosecution, he subsequently fled the country to New Zealand. For almost an entire year, the press and law enforcement knew Dr. Fox was Adam's community psychiatrist, yet this knowledge was not released to the public. After the Sandy Hook event, the Connecticut State Police contacted Dr. Fox about Adam's medical records. Paul Fox states he destroyed all of his records pertaining to Adam Lanza. Another source of information the child advocate uses in its search for recommendations for public healthcare system improvement comes from Andrew Solomon, son of Howard Solomon, the CEO of the pharmaceutical giant Forest Laboratories. Andrew Solomon, the first and only member of the media to interview the reclusive Peter Lanza, albeit off camera, is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, the largest think tank in the U.S., a think tank that was organized and designed to shape public opinion. Andrew Solomon became the poster child of the pharmaceutical industry when he allegedly overcame his depression by using the drug Celexa, the same drug to which Adam Lanza would allegedly later have an adverse reaction. Celexa is the drug that put Howard Solomon's Forest Laboratories on the map. In reality, Andrew Solomon was addicted to medication, treating his depression from 1994 to 2013, taking a cocktail of meds in a single sitting. These are the types of sources the child advocate uses to validate recommendations for public health system improvement. If we are to believe the OCA report, Nancy actually did more than enough to get proper medical treatment for Adam. She placed him in a birth-to-three program for his expressive language delay. An IEP was set up for Adam for his speech and language impairment. She placed him in occupational therapy. She took him to the Yale Child Study Center. she sought out a community psychiatrist and sought out homebound education. Yet the OCA somehow preposterously concludes, despite previously listing the many instances Nancy sought mental health professionals, that AL's story highlights the need to address the profound gaps in our continuum of services for children with developmental and mental health needs. Consider this as well. If the reports are true, Yale Child Study Center could be seen as having failed Adam. Their failure was outlined when nurse Kathleen Koenig prescribed Adam the drug Celexa. According to the state police report, specifically immediately after prescribing a small dose of Celexa to Adam Lanza, Koenig received a phone call from Nancy Lanza, which reported her son was unable to raise his arm. Koenig's seemingly unprofessional response to Nancy's decision to stop giving Celexa to Adam was that Nancy was being non-compliant. Yale Child Study Center played a pivotal role in the life of Adam, as Dr. Robert King and Kathleen Koenig received Adam various times. The Sandy Hook Commission, which was tasked with making recommendations for mental health care in the state, relied heavily on the OCA report and allowed Yale Child Study Center to testify before the committee. How does the state rationalize this blatant conflict of interest in determining future mental health care? Even further, Yale has been reluctant to give up any documentation pertaining to Adam Lanza for public perusal, and has even fought against the seeking of such information. For example, Dr. Ezra Griffith, a psychiatrist at Yale University, sat on the commission. When Harold Schwartz, behavioral psychiatrist at Hartford Hospital, insisted that the committee should seek out Adam's medical information from Peter Lanza, Ezra Griffith argued against it.
But I am making the case that it is a matter of great public interest, and I think the public is interested in it. And while we can't make a link directly to reducing the risk of future violence, everything that we learn, everything that we can possibly learn about every individual who perpetrates such violence is a little incremental piece of knowledge that may help, and we, I believe, have to pursue it.
Yeah, Hank, I just don't understand what is so crucially important or what you're going to do with the information.
So with regard to educating, if our report is not about educating the public, I don't know what it's about. What are we here? What are we doing if we're not educating people about the role of law enforcement and school safety and mental health and the school safe school climate with everything that we've learned? I think that's what it's all about. So, but with regard to, you know, why I'd want to know about, you know, a particular individual case, I just can't understand how we could not be interested. There's suggestive material that suggests that Adam Lanza may have had a severe mental illness during the last 3 months of his life, living alone in his home with black plastic bags on his windows, communicating with no one except his mother by email, assuming that stuff is true. I mean, we don't have the investigatory power to know it, but for the sake of discussion, assuming that it's true, he may have developed a psychotic illness during that time. I think that's important to know.
The question most people ask is, why did Adam do it? After seeing the factual inaccuracies from authoritative reports, misinformation from the media, discrepancies in his genealogy, and the withholding of documents from the public, perhaps the question should now be rephrased to, did Adam do it? In August of 2015, 16 Sandy Hook families settled on a $1.5 million lawsuit against the estate of Nancy Lanza. The money was split evenly. The lawsuit alleged that Nancy knew or should have known that Adam Lanza's mental and emotional condition made him a danger to others. As we have already established, nobody in the public domain knows the true mental and emotional condition of Adam Lanza, so how could the court possibly rule in favor of the families? In fact, many of Adam Lanza's acquaintances seem to allege he was a nice, shy kid and not a danger to others.
He was just a kid.
Just a kid?
Just a kid.
Never antisocial?
No, I'm just gonna... No.
Troublemaker?
No, no, definitely not.
Noticeable? Did he just kind of blend into the background?
Yeah. Nothing that would warrant any of this.
They're saying he went after his mom and her class of kids. Can you wrap your head around that?
No, I cannot. I don't know who do anything like this.
So your general sense is what?
This is unspeakable. I first heard about it. I'm still in shock. Excuse me a moment, I want to go.
He was a nice kid, very polite. She raised very nice boys to me. That's why I think it's a shock to even know them and realize who they are and what he did. You can't understand what happened, that he snapped, what have you, and he took such innocent lives.
He's a very intelligent person. He really was. It's just like, you know, the way he acted around other people was just very withdrawn and just really quiet.
A little different.
Yeah.
They were in the high school tech club together, spent a lot of time on computers. Adam had his own style of dressing.
He kind of had like the stereotypical nerd look. Like, you know, like khaki pants, belt, tucked-in shirt. He even had, like, a little computer case, or, like, kind of like a briefcase instead of, like, a backpack like everyone else. He even, like, had, like, a little pocket protector that he had pens in. We kind of had a feeling that there might have been something wrong with him, but obviously we never asked. We never thought it was our place to do so. He was really into games, and if I recall, he actually picked up on StarCraft really quickly.
Let's now analyze the events leading up to the alleged crime and the crime scene itself. Leading up to the event, Nancy was describing to family and friends a potentially terminal illness she had. In emails sent to her friend Marvin LaFontaine, she states, "My diagnosis was not good. I was going under the premise that I had a limited time left, about 12 months." Nancy indicated to LaFontaine that Adam's issues, like hers, were genetic. According to the OCA report, a report already called into question, both Nancy and Adam had a potential seizure disorder. But once again, without access to medical records, it is impossible to know for sure. The most recent picture of Nancy we have seen is from 2011. She is at a wedding reception with Ryan. Adam is not pictured. Despite all reports of Nancy continuously caring for Adam, we have yet to see a single photograph of the two of them together. On December 10th, 4 days prior to the event, Adam was said to have been bleeding after bumping his head. How he bumped his head or the severity of the injury is unknown. The following day, Nancy took her 10th and final vacation of the year, previously traveling to Boston, New York, Maine, Toronto, London, San Francisco, Nantucket, Charlotte, and Baltimore, according to Adam's aunt, Marcia Lanza. Nancy checked into the Omni Mount Washington Resort Hotel in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire on December 11th and checked out on December 13th, the day prior to the Sandy Hook event. The media portrays her final trip as a type of experiment to see if Adam could handle time at home alone. But if Nancy had already taken several trips in the preceding months, this portrayal would obviously be false. The details surrounding the Omni trip warrant deeper examination.
Her trip to the resort is interesting because we're given a little bit of detail about it, and then we're given really vague things that we should be provided with, like the phone documentation. Who was her last outgoing phone call to, and who did she meet when she got there in New Hampshire? So she checked into the hotel supposedly at 12:10 in the afternoon on December 11th, and she had dinner there at Stickney's by herself, supposedly. It was a very costly dinner. Nancy, after eating dinner that night that she arrived there on the 11th, moved on to a bar called The Cave at the hotel where she drank alone until closing time at midnight. And the source that he interviewed, which presumably I always thought was probably the bartender, who had served Nancy, they said that she had a glazed look on her face, much like she was drinking to forget rather than drinking to have a good time. She did the same thing the following night. The next night on the 12th, receipts show that Nancy dined again at Stickney's at Mount Omni, eating another costly meal. And that night while she was eating, she sent a text message to her friend John Berquist of Sandy Hook. And the text talks about, you know, some elegantly dressed couple who had tattoos poking out of their evening wear. She checked out on December 13th, which is, I think, one of the most crucial days to look at, too, because her checkout time was 12:27 p.m., From there, she headed towards a restaurant called the Three Tomatoes in Lebanon, New Hampshire, where she met with an old friend who knew her mother and who she just had recently connected with that summer in 2012. I've always wondered who this mystery man was. I mean, he is, after all, one of the last people to have ever seen Nancy alive. I asked James Champion, Nancy's brother, about this person during our little text exchange and if he knew who it was, and he said that he did. He said that she was an old friend from high school. This caught me by surprise because since every account I've seen of this meeting specifically mentions that this person was a man who even talked about the possibility of visiting Nancy in Newtown with his wife. So when I brought up the contradiction in the media reports to James, that's when he ended our communication. So whoever this person was, I've heard one thing from one source and I've seen another thing from all the other sources that everybody else has seen. So after leaving this restaurant at 2:30, the next known whereabouts of Nancy Lanza leads to the New Hampshire Commission of Liquor, which is a liquor store located in Claremont, New Hampshire. So she went shopping at some outlet mall, then took the I-91 south to the Whole Foods in Connecticut from the liquor store, which would take about 2 hours and 14 minutes. So we can only surmise based on the official summary report that Nancy arrived home sometime around 10 p.m.
Nancy arrived home the night of December 13th. On the following morning, it is said she was shot 4 times while sleeping in her bed. These are photographs of Nancy's bedroom taken from the police report. It is interesting to note that in the on-scene call log, it is reported that the Savage 22 caliber rifle that Adam allegedly used had 3 live rounds and only 1 spent round, contradicting the photographs of the spent shell casings on the floor. Sabrina provided us with other strange details surrounding this scene.
I've been privy to private conversations between her and Marvin LaFontaine, including those redacted emails that were given to the producers of the PBS Frontline special Raising Adam Lanza. I have the unredacted emails from them and some newer ones, too, from 2009 to 2010. One of the things that we looked at when we were writing the book is the way he spoke of Nancy Lanza in interviews. And in that Frontline special in particular, you know, how he made a connection with Nancy when he picked up his boy from Boy Scouts after, you know, work one day. And I thought, okay, the way he talks about her, it just seems a little bit more in depth than just a friend. And I had suspicions that perhaps he had feelings for her, maybe even an affair. He admitted to me that my suspicions were correct and that he was having an affair with Nancy Lanza. He definitely was attracted to Nancy. They, according to him, were together. And he was still talking to her 6 months before the shooting happened. We've developed a nice working relationship with Marvin. He left a review on our book page on Amazon that disclosed a very cryptic thing about this whole case that not a lot of people know. According to Marvin, Nancy Lanza's bedroom wall had blood writing on it, written in her blood using a Q-tip. And his information, I think, is credible because it comes from his good friend and the chief of police in the small town of Kingston, New Hampshire, Chief Donald Briggs Jr. And when Chief Donald Briggs asked the Connecticut State Police what the message said, he was told no comment, and nothing further was ever discussed about it.
If nothing else, LaFontaine's testimony to Sabrina adds yet another conflicting account to the already numerous amounts of contradictions surrounding this case. It was noted in the IMS documentary film We Need to Talk About Sandy Hook, there was heavy police activity set up next door to the Lanza home soon after the event. The home in question is owned by John Trent Acosta, president and CEO of Newtown Savings Bank, and former appointed council member of the New York Federal Reserve. Recall that the donation money given to the victim's family members was provided by the United Way and routed by John Trentacosta's Newtown Savings Bank. Curiously, despite being a next-door neighbor to the Lanzas and having direct responsibility for Newtown's donations, the media failed to ask John Trentacosta about his knowledge and relationship to the Lanzas. Looking at the Sandy Hook School crime scene, we notice that the school is isolated, on its own, directly behind the firehouse. The owners of the houses located directly behind the school also have major ties to banks. William McCarthy is the vice president and chief financial officer at Newtown Savings Bank. Coincidentally, both the president and vice president of Newtown Savings Bank live within just a few feet of both crime scenes. There is major concern over whether or not the event at Sandy Hook took place as reported. That is not our primary concern here. Our main concern in this report is focused on who Adam Lanza was, the misreports surrounding his life, the withholding of documents, and if he had anything to do with the alleged crimes. It is unknown if the on-scene identification of Adam Lanza was made through his driver's license. Even though various reports indicate that he received his license in 2010, there is no indication in the police report that they have a copy of his license. Only a learner's permit and a registration for his license are listed.
She was very excited about the fact that he got his driver's license in 2010.
It is alleged that after he shot and murdered his mother, he drove his mother's 2010 Honda Civic to Sandy Hook Elementary School. The initial gunshots were said to be heard around 9:34 a.m. And according to the Sedensky report, it is believed the shooter killed himself at 9:40 a.m. Only around 6 minutes elapsed from the time Adam Lanza allegedly walked in the school and committed suicide. The report states that after Adam broke the front glass, he entered the north hallway where he shot and killed two staff members. Two other staff members were allegedly injured during the initial barrage of gunfire. Here we have our first witness account, Natalie Hammond, who was said to have been hit in her foot, leg, and hand, reported that she saw the gunman wearing a mask. Hammond's account of a mask is scattered throughout the police report and later relayed by news outlets and people she knew. The gunman was wearing a dark hat and mask. Hammond related that she saw a person with a mask and that Hawksprung and Sherlock had been shot. That Hammond told her that the shooter had been wearing a mask. But Hammond did tell her that the shooter was wearing a mask. She stated she thought he had a black mask on. Also recall that the Newtown Bee released an article quoting Principal Don Hawksprung's account of the initial events. The Bee later retracted the article because Don Hawksprung was supposedly already dead. In the article, the Bee states, Principal Don Hawksprung told the Bee that a masked man entered the building. Would the Newtown Bee mistake Natalie Hammond with Don Hawksprung? Would Natalie Hammond conduct an interview while she was dealing with multiple gunshot wounds? The report of a mask contradicts what the police describe on scene. Her account is discussed by police at various intervals within the report. She stated she thought he had a black mask on. This alarmed me because the lone gunman, who was down, had no mask. We had received a description that the shooter was dressed in all black and wearing a mask. She reported the shooter was wearing black and had a mask. This was not what we had observed in room 10. According to the report, the next area Lanza went was the main office where the secretary was hiding. The secretary states, I saw a man standing in the lobby facing down the primary hallway to the first grade and second grade classrooms. The man appeared white and was wearing a soft rim type hat and dark sunglasses. She then states she ran and hid under her desk and reported, "The door to the office opened and I heard footsteps of a person walking across the floor. I couldn't see anything. I just heard footsteps." She then got up and hid with the nurse in her office for 4 hours. The nurse states, through a hole in the back of the computer desk, she observed from the knees down a person standing directly in front of her with feet pointed towards her. The person's pants looked dark blue and the boots were black. The report of the nurse was directly contradicted by the media. Reporter Andrea McCarron claims that the nurse and the gunman met eyes.
She was the school nurse at Sandy Hook Elementary and was for 15 years. She described the gunman coming into her office. They met eyes, she jumped under her desk, and he inexplicably just walked out.
McCarron has yet to explain where she got her information.
When I heard the door close, you know, and he probably walked in, and I was looking, and I saw I could see him from the knees down.
At the same time shots were reportedly being fired, the librarian called the office after hearing clicking noises over the intercom. While people were screaming and dying, Secretary Barbara Halstead, ex-wife of Sandy Hook Fire Chief Bill Halstead, had a quick moment to answer a couple of phone calls before hiding in a closet with the nurse. After the librarian hung up the phone, she began locking her doors. When she attempted to lock the third door, she states she saw a man in the hallway with a gun. Here is a CNN interview with the librarian, which was aired on December 15, 2012, the day after the event. Note, she doesn't mention seeing a man with a gun.
We had to move out of that spot because one of our doors wasn't locked, we discovered, so we went into a back storage room and locked the kids in there.
How close
were
you together?
Children quiet?
We were like this close together.
How did you panic?
There was crayons and paper in the storage room in the back, and we tore some up and gave them clipboards and had them color and draw pictures.
And what did you tell them?
Was it you or were you alone?
There was three other adults with me. They were asking what's going on. We said, we don't know. Our job is to stay quiet. It may be a drill, it may not, but we're just going to stay here.
And you didn't know at that point?
We knew, because I called the office and she told me there was a shooter.
One month later, investigators questioned her again on her statement of seeing a man with a gun in the hallway. She stated this time that she did not have her glasses on when she observed the man, but she believed that he was a first responder who was not dressed in a uniform. During the 6-minute time frame that Lanza was allegedly on a shooting spree, there was no first responder in the building. Other descriptions of the shooter come from the children's statements in the report. Some describe the shooter as wearing a mask. Others state he was wearing sunglasses. Several children describe the gunman having a beard. Many people, including adults, reported hearing popping or clicking sounds over the intercom. Some children compared the sounds to kicking a door or pans falling. It is not clear how sounds of an AR-15 fired within a confined area can be compared to pans falling or clicking sounds. In an interview with the parent of a surviving student, she stated that her child recently added the detail that when the shooter came in the room, he pointed the gun individually at each person, but didn't say anything to anyone. All of this, including the alleged mass murder of 26 people, occurred within a 6-minute time frame. After entering Classroom 8 and Classroom 10, the gunman allegedly committed suicide in Room 10. A flex-fit hat with a bullet hole in the forward portion of the top of the hat and some hairs sticking out is seen within the police report. The hairs were not tested to see if they matched Lanza. The police report describes the hole in the gunman's hat along with his entry and exit wound thusly. This hole was consistent with having been worn by the shooter at the time the shooter received a bullet to the right rear lower portion of his head, which exited out the top portion of his head and hat. So, according to the police report, Adam Lanza received a bullet to the back of his head, which exited out through the top. This is in direct contradiction to the autopsy report. The final medical examiner's report on Adam Lanza's anatomical diagnosis indicates he committed suicide from an intraoral gunshot wound. According to Merriam-Webster's dictionary, intraoral is defined as situated, occurring, or performed within the mouth. So, did he receive a bullet to the back right rear portion of his head, or did the shot occur within the mouth? The only way to clarify this for certain is through post-mortem photographs. Fortunately, the police report indicates that Adam Lanza's post-mortem exam included a digital photography report completed on December 16, 2012. Photographs were taken of his exit wound on the top of his head. Unfortunately, and very suspiciously, there is no indication that photographs were taken of the back of his head. Lines 13 through 18 in the digital post-mortem report indicate photos were taken on the top of his head. To reiterate, there is no indication photos were taken of the back of his head. The police report is very clear, stating that the shooter received a bullet to the right rear lower portion of his head. It even goes on to state that the trajectory of the bullet exited the top of his head, striking but not penetrating a corrugated metal ceiling, ricocheting off the metal and later located above the ceiling tile in classroom 8. The DNA report is also controversial. Although Adam's DNA is said to have been found on certain parts of his weapons, there are other instances in which DNA was found and was not Adam's. Most of the DNA findings of Adam Lanza were mixtures, meaning that the DNA found on the given items contained the DNA of two or more people. DNA was said to have been extracted from the exterior door handles, but it was not from Nancy or Adam. And due to insufficient amounts of DNA being generated from the interior car door handles, no comparisons could be made. There were also traces of DNA found on the trigger of the Bushmaster rifle, the pistol grip of the Bushmaster rifle, the shoulder stock of the Bushmaster rifle, a chambered round, the feed area and side of the magazine, and the cartridges from the magazine. Both Adam and Nancy were eliminated as contributors to the DNA found on those items. Whose DNA it was remains a mystery. There was also DNA found on the .22 caliber cartridges found in Nancy Lanza's bedroom. When police ran the DNA through the database, the results came up empty. We attempted to contact forensic analyst Eric Carita about the controversial aspects of the DNA report. He never responded. The forensic team also did bullet evidence analysis. They attempted to test unused ammo found at the crime scene to prove the 5.56 caliber bullets were fired by the Bushmaster rifle. Their results state, no positive identification could be made to any of the bullet evidence submissions noted above in 5.56 millimeter caliber. The physical condition of the bullet jacket surfaces were severely damaged and corroded. The Bushmaster rifle cannot be eliminated as having fired the 5.56 caliber bullet evidence examined. They also compared the alleged suicide bullet found in the ceiling to other unused 10mm bullets found at the scene. However, no positive identification could be made during these examinations. They all lacked sufficient striae for comparison. It is not far-fetched to believe that Connecticut officers would take part in a conspiracy. After all, Connecticut has earned its nickname of Corrupticut. Just recently, Newtown Police Sergeant Stephen Santucci pleaded guilty to a steroid, prescription pill, and cocaine distribution ring in which he and 11 others took part, including a Newtown Police Department dispatcher.
A Newtown police officer, an emergency dispatcher, and a state judicial marshal all facing charges tonight for their role in a drug ring.
Police were selling steroids and prescription drugs right here in Connecticut.
The U.S. District Attorney's Office and several other law enforcement agencies have been working on this long-term investigation into steroid and prescription pill distribution.
Inside the Newtown Police Department, two men, a sergeant and a dispatcher, busted by federal authorities accused of importing and distributing steroids. The U.S. District Attorney's Office says the investigation went on for nearly 2 months. Police Sergeant Stephen Santucci of Waterbury. He's accused of receiving steroids and related materials from China since 2011.
The integrity of Connecticut police officers was also put into question when they were viewed on dash cams snacking on food and drinks less than 3 hours into the Sandy Hook event, while people were still unaccounted for inside. How are we supposed to know who Adam Lanza was, or if he was connected to the alleged crime scene, if the authorities are reluctant to be forthcoming with essential documents? And why is it, when people try to legally retrieve Lanza's documents, they are intimidated and threatened?
Well, when we arrived in Sandy Hook, the mom proceeded to show us around the area of where the event took place, and because we had worked on other school shootings, such as Virginia Tech and Red Lake, Minnesota, we were trying to urge the federal government to do public hearings on the federal level regarding the link between school shootings and the use of psychiatric drugs. Get the local area to support us, signatures to support a petition to release Adam Lanza's mental health and medical records. We came back on a Saturday morning to find out, when we went to go set up our petition booth, that we were no longer welcome at the facility. We were told that the owner did not need to give us a reason why he rescinded his approval for us to collect signatures. One of the first responders confronted the mother and asked to look at her petition, and was very angry and intimidating. So we left there. On Saturday, it was quite busy. There were lines of cars to get into the dump and the recycling facility, and we were told that a lot of lawmakers that run for office often go to that facility to reach out to residents. What happened then was we got tremendous support. Within 2 hours, we received close to 300 signatures with a 99% support to release Adam Lanza's mental health and medical records. However, two police officers flew in at a fairly, you know, speedy arrival, came out of their cars with their doors open, leaving their doors open, and launched over to myself and the other mother and demanded us to disclose why we were there, who we were. I was told that they received a verbal complaint that we were calling people names, which simply wasn't true. But with that, they started to threaten us. If they received any more complaints, that they would have to take us in. The men in charge there said they had received no complaints, and at that time they continued to threaten us, to shut us down. The mother knew one of the police officers and felt very scared for the safety of her children, that they would suffer the brunt of any further actions of her petitioning with Able Child. So I turned over my business card and wrote down my cousin's name on the back of my business card, who happened to be the Deputy Attorney General of the United States. If they did arrest me, that's who I would be reaching out to. Whether or not he took my call or not, I don't know. But I was sufficiently frightened. During our time in Newtown, both the mother was followed, I was followed. She had a car surface in front of our house, and we were sufficiently scared. If it was a private security firm or the Newtown police, they were in unmarked cars. For me particularly, it was a non-police car that followed me in and out of the town every time I arrived there. Able Child, you know, when you say, could you speculate as to why this was done, the one word that comes to my mind is corruption. It's not a conspiracy. It's not a hoax. It's what we call corruption. It's a criminal act that is being covered up. So without the information, it's very difficult to determine what criminal act is being covered up. We can't get to the criminal act if we don't have the information. Millions of dollars have been appropriated based on the assumption that Adam Lanza did not receive appropriate mental health services. Only complete disclosure of his records will answer this question.
If there is nothing to hide, If this is a straightforward, case-closed shooting, then why not release the documents? The police say they have in their possession images of Adam posing with weapons and holding a gun to his head. Why not release these to the public? After all, we are bombarded with similar imagery on a daily basis by media. The withholding of information makes everything all the more suspicious, especially when there are reports that this event might have been planned well in advance.
Since we're on the topic of Lanza, I was contacted several weeks into 2013 by an individual, actually through his attorney, who remarked that, and confirmed, I think, to my satisfaction, that he was a consultant for U.S. intelligence, and that the party that was involved in overseeing the Sandy Hook event was at the beck and call of the Obama administration, and that there were also Council on Foreign Relations personnel involved as well. And there was a party, there was a group that was convened to discuss what type of event would provide the pretext for gun control measures to be enacted in the United States. And this was in late 2012. And it was suggested by this party that an individual who had Asperger's or some set of learning disabilities would be most appropriate, because that could also ensure these mental health protocols being implemented, or at least being introduced and ramped up in subsequent months and years. It's also something whereby this individual is not crazed. They are someone who it suggests that this is something that could happen to anyone, right? Rather, it's something that let me rephrase that. It is suggests that this could result from any sort of corner, right? Someone with Asperger's, someone with ADHD that simply cannot focus. All of a sudden, they become psychotic and create this, carry out an event of this magnitude.
To really understand the life of Adam, we need access to more information. The public has a right to know, and there is something we can all do to become more proactive in this regard.
Now that the Sandy Hook shooting investigation has been completed, and with the passage of 3 years, there are no further milestones in which the public might learn more about the event or Adam Lanza. The empirical details of Adam's life and the true chain of events leading up to the shooting haven't been revealed, and what has is insufficient for public inquest. Many documents and records obtained through investigation and other activities were either not mentioned in the reports or were redacted. It's through the provisions of FOIA that this information can be obtained upon request. In the time that has transpired since the event, requests for the missing details have been submitted through the FOIA process by members of the public and various media outlets. One notable figure who has submitted numerous requests is Wolfgang Halbig, who has a background in law enforcement, education, as well as school security. When his requests were largely denied, or it was deemed that no material was responsive to his request, hearings were held by the Connecticut Freedom of Information Commission to deliberate the matter and allow Mr. Halbig an opportunity to challenge the findings. Ultimately, the hearings did little to loosen the state's grip on the key material. Able Child, the parents' rights organization, submitted FOIA requests for Adam Lanza's medical records and toxicology report. When the responsible agencies denied the requests, they too faced the FOIA commission in a hearing over the matter. For the FOIA system to serve the public's interest, the agencies must fulfill the requests without bias or prejudice. Because this isn't always the case, the system isn't perfect. Our group, IMS, made a single FOIA request in June of 2015 for very specific evidence related to Adam Lanza. In the complete official report of the Sandy Hook event, in a PDF file labeled Meehan Suspect Autopsy Photos, are 18 photos. The photos, however, are all redacted. We requested photos of Adam Lanza, the shooter, obtained at the primary crime scene and through later investigation, including at the time of autopsy. During one of our numerous calls to the FOIA Commission, we were told this.
From the time you ask for the document that you're looking for, okay, they have 4 days to get back to you and say, you know, we got your request, we're working on it, whatever. If you don't hear anything within, say, a week, you can file an FOI complaint with us.
One of the agency's staff attorneys told us something similar.
Well, if they don't give you the records within 4 days, you can file a complaint with this agency.
After a week had passed since our initial request, we began to inquire with the custodian of records and the FOIA Commission about the status. After numerous calls and voicemails, we were told that a Christine Plords in the Legal Affairs Department of the Connecticut State Police had been assigned to respond. After finally reaching her, Christine explained that the material that was responsive to our request was available on their website. What she meant was that any photos responsive to our request were available in the official report of the Sandy Hook event. When it was clear that there was no intent to reconcile the issue of the photos being redacted and the public's right to them, we filed an appeal with the FOIA Commission as well as the Connecticut State Police. After 2 weeks, we received a response from the commission stating that they were in receipt of our letter to the state police as well as their office. They stated their office was not a repository of records and to make sure that all requests are sent to the agencies that maintain the records we seek. They further stated that, if denied access, we may file a complaint with the FOIA commission. This seemed odd as the letter clearly noted it was regarding FOIA appeal file number 15-461. This was, in effect, the FOIA Commission giving us the runaround by responding to our inquiries without responding to our complaint or appeal itself. A few weeks later, we received notice that a hearing with the Commission had been scheduled over the matter of being denied the materials requested. Upon consideration of the results of similar hearings and other strategies on the table, we formally withdrew our request. When we began production of this documentary, Professor James Tracy explained that efforts had been underway for a long time to hinder his media criticism. Less than 2 weeks before the release of this production, he was dealt another savage blow. It won't be a surprise to some that it relates to Sandy Hook.
FAU plans to fire a professor widely known for his conspiracy theories. School officials say he took things a little too far, accusing parents of Sandy Hook victims of lying about their children's death. News Channel 5's Jacqueline Powell live with the steps the university is taking this morning. Jacqueline?
Well, Mike, James Tracy has been talking about his conspiracy theories on his blog about mass shootings and massacres.
Administrators at Florida Atlantic University still are not saying why the university is taking steps to fire Professor James Tracy. We learned Tracy apparently taunted one of the families who lost their son in the Sandy Hook massacre.
James Tracy, seen here in a previous interview with News Channel 5, is no stranger to controversy. For 4 years, his blog entitled been filled with material considered to be conspiracy theorist in nature. Stephen Ochoa says the professor is entitled to his own opinion when it comes to the Sandy Hook massacre or any other posts on his blog.
Was what he said wrong? You know, I don't know if it was wrong. It was his opinions at the end of the day.
After watching that brief collection of media clips relating to Professor James Tracy, it looks like he's the one being harassed. And there's little doubt that it's a coordinated effort. a perfect example of why it's always best to look more deeply into a story if you hope to find the truth. What, if anything, we think you may have learned from this documentary is that it's virtually impossible to draw any significant conclusions about what took place at Sandy Hook Elementary School back in 2012, the truth about Adam Lanza, or even whether a mass murder took place at all. We wish to state unequivocally that the people interviewed as part of this production, Sheila Matthews, James Tracy, Sabrina Phillips, hold their own views which do not necessarily comport with those of the producers. Not even the producers and others who contributed to the production agree about what most likely took place. And therein lies the crux of the matter. No matter your views on privacy or national security or the authorities' practice of determining what information the public has a right to obtain, we think most will agree that if we truly want to learn about Adam Lanza and what happened in Sandy Hook, it will require full disclosure. The producers of this documentary think it's the right of the people to have it.
Gary King, and I've assembled the most formidable JFK team on planet Earth. We've got Dr. James Fetzer, Larry Rivera, who is the number one researcher in the world today when it comes to new research, and we've got Don Fox, who's not afraid to look a little bit deeper than anyone else. So if you're interested in what happened to the 35th President of the United States, then I invite you to our show. It's called The New JFK Show. And it's on YouTube. Go to Gary King YouTube channel, and we've got over 90 shows archived for you there. So if you really want to know the truth, and knowing that over 9 out of 10 researchers are working the other side of the street in a sea of disinformation, I pledge to you the truth about JFK. Go to Gary King YouTube channel and find out your true history.